Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Off the Shelf and the University of Sheffield, in which neuroscientists Dr. Elsie Place and PhD student Thomas Cousins talk to local artist Kid Acne, also known as Ed, about their collaboration for BioFest. BioFest is a unique festival taking place in Sheffield throughout November, showcasing cutting-edge bioscience research from the University of Sheffield through a programme of free events, films, talks, art and exhibitions.
Hello, I'm Elsie.
Hi, I'm Tom.
We both work at the University of Sheffield in the area of neuroscience, and I work on the development of the embryonic brain and specifically an area called the hypothalamus.
Whereas I look on understanding how the brain works and more specifically how neurons communicate with each other to create our thoughts and memories.
So Tom, how do you go about studying how memories are made?
Well, I look at fruit flies, so tiny little flies that you might often find in bowls of bananas if you leave them out too long. I look at understanding how the features of neurons in an area of their brain called the mushroom body contributes to their memories.
A mushroom body, so is that like a brain? Do flies have brains?
Yeah, so flies surprisingly do have brains. They're about the size of a poppy seed, which always astounds people when I tell them. Yeah, so flies do actually have brains like a lot of other insects. The way we study them is we look at this area, like you said, called the mushroom body, which specifically codes their the memories of smells. So whether a smell is good or whether a smell is bad, so they can learn to go towards bananas if they think they're tasty and go away from vinegar if they don't want to be near it, that sort of thing.
So can that tell us something about how human brains work?
Yeah, so I think there is a lot to be learned. Obviously, the issue with studying humans is you can't really open up a human's brain and look inside, not ethically anyway. The solution to that is looking at different model organisms like rats or mice, which are very common. Now, the reason we look at Drosophila or fruit flies is because they have very, very simple brains and simple memories in comparison to what we have. And so we basically just look at this simple memory of, oh yeah, this odor's good, this odor's bad, and specifically look at features of neurons and how they adapt to being overactivated or overstimulated. And from that, we can kind of learn how do neurons work in humans and in mice and rats and all other organisms, because there is kind of core features that they all share with each other, like how they adapt and how certain genes are expressed, that sort of thing. So you look at a slightly more complex organism with chickens and their embryos. Do you want to tell me about that?
Yeah, so like you, people are often quite surprised when they hear I work on chickens. But chickens are actually a really great model for looking at the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is a very ancient region of the brain that's responsible for many, many different critical functions to support life. So it's involved in homeostasis, maintaining your temperature, your blood osmolarity. It's involved in regulating many hormones. It's also involved in sleep, circadian rhythms, so, you know, your day-night cycle, the menstrual cycle too. But it's also involved in many different behaviours, like feeding behaviours, reproductive behaviours, behaviours to do with temperature regulation, like seeking warmth or putting on clothes when you're cold. And because some of these functions are so ancient and so critical, it means that the hypothalamus in some ways hasn't changed that much through evolution. So we can look at other vertebrate species like the chicken, and what we find in the chicken, we find we can often apply to human beings.
So you've talked a little bit about why you work on chickens versus, you know, humans or mice or rats, but what's so important about the hypothalamus? Now, you've said it has many of these different roles. What is kind of relatable that people can understand about what the hypothalamus actually does for you?
Well, one way to think about that is to consider the sorts of problems you might have if your hypothalamus isn't working properly. And given all those important functions I just listed, you could end up with fertility problems, insomnia, or problems with your blood pressure. Your body weight might change even though you're eating normally, or your appetite could suddenly change. You might be really tired or feel cold or weak. And some of this could be due to problems with your hormonal control, like your thyroid or growth hormones. So there's relevance to a number of major societal ills like obesity, for example, and various stress and psychiatric disorders that are thought to have a hypothalamic component to them. But the work we do is basic science, and that means our job is to contribute to an understanding of how the hypothalamus works so that others can use that to help study disease and figure out treatments. And surprisingly, despite how important it is, the hypothalamus is quite poorly understood relative to other brain regions. And one way that our work gets picked up by other scientists is in the stem cell field. These scientists aim to generate specific cell types from an early embryonic-like state. And critically, in this way, they can generate human cell types that it might otherwise be impossible to gather. These cells can then potentially be used to directly replace cells in the body that have been lost or damaged through injury or disease, or else to study their biology in health and disease, or to test whether drugs are effective, say. This type of work relies very heavily on insights from the kind of work I do on embryonic development, because to guide these stem cells towards particular fates, those stem cell scientists usually try to recreate the sequence of signals that those cells usually encounter in the embryo.
So Elsie and I, obviously coming from slightly different places in our research, we wanted to really try and understand the similarities between them when we went to speak to Ed and try and talk about what the project was going to end up being. And the thing we kind of settled on in the end was this idea that we go from that single cell all the way to the complex thinking person, and that sort of idea of assembling yourself from the very starting point that all organisms share to becoming a completely unique individual, in where every human is different from each other in many different ways, and try and understand how that complexity is built along the way. So we've come here on a miserable Friday, Friday where it's super rainy, to chat to Ed about how the progress with the project is going. Obviously, me and Elsie have absolutely no idea what any of it is going to look like, so very interested to see that.
Well, welcome. So I've taken over a temporary space at Yorkshire Art Space down at Castlegate for this project, and I'm at the set of the process at the minute where I've assembled canvases. I've got them to kind of scale and format that I want to work on, and now I'm starting to apply the paint to them. So there's not a lot to see at the moment, but hopefully you get a sense of the scale of the work and which direction it's going to be going in. So bearing in mind that the paintings are going to be going into Firth Court, I looked at the available wall space there, the size of existing paintings, and made some decisions about what scale I should be working to. So on the whole, these paintings are 1m20 by 1m60. Some of them a single canvas, and that's the dimensions in its entirety. Others are going to be made of sections and assembled together. And that's sort of a play on the working title that we've got, the assembly of the self, but also the fact that there's been so many diagrams, schematics, just tons of information to look at. I found it quite hard to make a decision of making a single composition when actually I thought it might be nice to make several compositions and then assemble them together, and then that would form the overall painting.
So Ed, we're standing in your studio and we're surrounded by many sketches. We've got some really huge sketches on this wall in front of us, and behind us we've got all these A4 sheets with lots of smaller work on it. And I can see a lot of ideas represented here that we talked about when you came and visited us and we had that series of meetings. So can you tell us how this process came about and how you got involved in the project and just how you found it coming to visit us?
So I was invited to apply for the project. That was my introduction. I have worked with the university in the past on other projects. My process, which I laid out in my application, was that I wanted it to be very much a collaboration, that I wasn't sure what the end result would be, but I was going to see what the two of you kind of gave me in terms of material and visuals and what you were both excited by in your research. And then for that to just lead me organically to some kind of visual conclusion. So that's where I'm at the moment. So yeah, these drawings are all sketches that I made as we were talking about both of your research. And for example, the avoid and approach, I kept hearing again and again, and it's stood out to me to maybe introduce some typographic elements, because that's something that I'm known for in terms of painting large scale murals that are very bold and graphic with my own typographic style. So I was keen to try and incorporate some text into these images rather than them being purely diagrams and schematics. So that's something that I was keen to do. And I really like the scales, tipping the fly's brain in either direction is like, is this a reward or is this a punishment? So that's something else that I might try and incorporate. It's a luxury for me to kind of be able to print out all my sketches, have them on the wall in front of me, and then I can really read them back to myself and then go through them and see which ones are relevant and which ones aren't. Whereas if I'm just flicking through my sketchbook, I can forget what was on the previous page and not see what's on the next page. So it's really good for me to see it all in one go. And then in terms of the equipment, that was something else that I was really drawn to. This one in particular, I was just really drawn to, and I felt that I'd like to draw that on a large scale and to incorporate the colours that I was seeing on that day, what is actually under the microscope and the dye inside the egg yolk and everything. So that's inspiring the colours as well as the composition.
Yeah, I love these sketches of the two microscopes from our lab, and that one on the bottom there, that's my microscope with the star-shaped hole in the egg. So it really describes in quite a fun way, but also accurately, what we do when we come up to the lab to work on our embryos and we come and crack open the eggs. And you've got my toolbox there as well with all my dissecting kit in and some bottles off the shelf. I watched you make these sketches when you came up, but I didn't actually see the final results.
That's true. That's something that people don't often get to see is my sketchbook work. And when I had the retrospective exhibition at Millennium Galleries, we built a cabinet in the centre of the room. I had all my sketchbooks from the mid-90s laid out on a double page. And for all the effort that went into the whole show, that was everyone's favourite bit, I think. And that was the easiest. It was a real sort of revelation for me, actually, that what I do and what comes quite naturally is what resonated with people the most. So that's really stayed with me since then. And now what I'm really trying to do in my final pieces is to keep that energy and immediacy from my sketchwork without it becoming too overthought, too contrived. I'm kind of treating the project almost, I do editorial illustration for magazines as part of my own practice. And it's really exciting to work to a brief and a deadline of something. I've no idea what it's going to be, but I know I need to hand it in. I know it's going to go to print. And it's about interpreting text and then turning that into picture form. So I'm treating this project almost like that, that these might, in another setting, they might end up being illustrations to accompany an article. But actually, in this setting, they're going to be paintings in a more of a fine art context. So I'm leaning more into somewhere between my fine art practice and my illustration practice, but it's not really got much to do with the street art stuff other than the sense of scale. The other thing I wanted to mention was it's the Cajal diagrams, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
That I loved, and they really looked to me like ordnance survey maps.
So Cajal, which I think is how you pronounce his name, was a Portuguese neuroscientist, I believe, and he came from a place of loving art to start with. But if I recall, his father had in mind for him that he needs to do medicine because his father was a doctor, and he said, no, you need to do something with research, you need to do medicine. But what I will say is maybe you can use your art for that. And I think Cajal eventually found this love of just staring at microscope under the microscope for hours at slices of brains from like mice and rats, I believe, and just looking at the shapes of neurons and drawing them and just with various stains. And it was actually him, again, I think, who figured out that neurons aren't just all connected like an information highway. They have gaps between them where they communicate with each other. And that's kind of what Ed was describing in these diagrams. And part of what Cajal was drawing was just drawing exactly what he was seeing and how the neurons are all arranged in these kind of complex patterns and almost, you know, like maps, like neuronal maps in a way of how everything is laid out.
So that's something that I'm really going to try and incorporate into this. And then in terms of my own style of drawing, there's a lineage between that, maybe like more pop art and street art. So Basquiat is a good example of someone that is very kind of raw and energetic work, but there's lots of layers to it. Again, there's often typographic annotations within the composition. So I think somewhere between those two, if I can do that, then I'll be really pleased that I've done my job.
So I can see what you were talking about the immediacy of your sketches, because we've got, you know, we've got these cracked edges of the eggshell there, and it's clearly been done quite quickly, and there's a real sort of dynamism to that. But as you said, you're working on a much, much bigger scale for the actual pieces. So what kind of materials are you going to be using, and how do you think you're going to, how do you think you're going to translate that immediacy in terms of like the way that you actually put the paint on the canvas?
It really is about scaling up those tools. So for this kind of proportion, I tend to work with really big chunky markers. I've got oil sticks, I've got graphite sticks, I've got, they're almost like bingo dabbers but full of ink, some quite DIY tools, and then some traditional fine art tools. But really it's just about getting the diameter of the implement that I want to draw onto the substrate with is got to be wider. And then the process is, rather than drawing from the wrist, it's more the elbow or the shoulder, and then just, it's quite a physical process. So
do you get quite a similar effect overall, or do you think the marks look really different because you're drawing from your elbow?
No, I think they end up, hopefully they end up very similar. The only difference is, in a sketchbook, you can just turn the page and do another one. When you're working on a canvas and you spend a day or so stretching it, prepping it, and then you've got like one chance to do the line work, it might take you 5 minutes, but it's getting everything to align perfectly. So that 5 minutes of expressive drawing has the desired effect.
How often do you just like do a canvas, you finish it, you think, okay, and then you think, this is rubbish, I don't want to use this? Or is everything kind of useful in that you're like, this could add to something, or maybe this is like a backup? Or
so my process has always been, since I was at art college, I always tend to stretch more canvases than I need, and I like to get into that muscle memory of drawing and mark making, and then it's like going to the gym, doing my warm-ups first, and then I'm ready to do it. It's not 100% success rate. The last exhibition I did was for a group show in Denver this summer. I think I showed 6 paintings, but I made 12. I knew they were going to pick between maybe 6 to 9, so I wanted to make at least 9. Once I was in the mode of doing it, I made a few extra, and then from that, we selected the ones that we wanted. So that's why there's lots of stretched canvases in this room. Some are lent up against the wall, just kind of ready to go, and they'll probably do that. That will be their function, is just to get used to the line width, the tools that I'm choosing to use. Something might actually be nicer than something else, and so it's me going with that process as well. The other thing I wanted to mention was I've got lots of newsprint as well. You know, the bridge between the street artwork and the fine artwork has been these kind of wheat pastes or paste-ups. So I either print or paint directly onto sheets in newsprint, very cheap, durable material, and then I can collage that into the composition after. So they, you know, in the past they got pasted up in the street, but then for exhibitions I paste them onto the canvas or onto board. So I might well kind of draw onto paper as well and collage that in, rather than necessarily drawing directly onto the canvas. But we'll see. But the fact that I've got a life-size printout of one of the illustrations means that I've got something that can really work to scale. So I'll find a way to kind of maintain those proportions and apply that to the canvas, whereas others might be a bit more impressionistic.
So is this kind of image the sort of thing we can expect for the works then? Are you thinking of basically reproducing these kinds of sketches on canvas at this large scale?
Yeah, so this one I've got my heart set on doing the microscope. I definitely want to paint that big. It will be as close to that sketch as possible, but in colour, and I want the colours to have that same kind of egg yolky meat dye, the purple dye that was in there, and have that as part of it. And then the center of it, because you had the lights shining into the center of the egg, I wanted the center of the painting to be brighter than the outside, and almost like in anime where there's those like moving stripes, you know, when they're flying through the air, that there'll be some sort of dynamic element to it. Yeah.
So Ed, please tell me you're going to reproduce some of these little embryo drawings in some of the final work. That's the one thing I long for.
Yes.
I can see suddenly you've got some little trochophore larvae of annelids there, and you've got a little cnidarian, larvae with jellyfish somewhere in there. You know, there will be chickens, maybe not up on the wall, but my favourite embryo, chicken embryo.
It will be. They will be in there in some shape or form, definitely.
So how do you take all the, like, so we've talked about all these single sketches you have at the microscope and the embryos and, you know, the avoid approach things. Obviously, the title we're kind of working with is Assembly of the Self. Do you have the idea of how all of those things assemble in the final piece already? Or do you think you'll do them and then look at it and say, okay, this is how this is going to look for the assembly of the self?
Yeah, I think it's going to... I feel like it's like getting a haircut, where it's like bit by bit it comes into shape and it comes into fruition. It's not necessarily clear lines from the start. It's just, as long as it's heading in the right direction, that funnel gets narrower and narrower, and then we get to the end result. So I think I will be painting the majority of these blank canvases, and then I will decide which ones I think are more successful. I'll continue to work on those, abandon the others, and then as I assemble them, that is how it's going to be. But in terms of the title, I'm just treating that now as a very much, that's just an umbrella term for this project. From assembling the canvases myself, for assembling this whole studio, from getting, you know, all my ducks in order, I feel like there's so many ways to interpret that title that have spoken to me along the way. I'm not sure how literal and how tenuous it's going to be yet, but hopefully it will all make sense in the end. I've really enjoyed the project. I mean, that's something else that I'm trying to take away. Like, there's so many things I've done over the years where I've met the deadline and produced the work, but I've not enjoyed the process. This one, of course, I want to be pleased with the end result, but I'm really enjoying the process. And that's quite sort of exciting in itself, of just being like happy to and feeling inspired to make work. So, yeah.
It's nice to hear you talking that way about the kind of the theme of assembly of the self and how it has parallels in the way that you're working. Because we started off, you know, we had various ways of thinking about this theme, and one was about the embryos themselves and the idea that you go from something very simple and step by step, you go through all these stages of iteratively increasing complexity, and you know, so I'm hearing echoes of that in what you're saying now.
So I think one of the things that's been really interesting is thinking about that buzzword of scientific communication, and thinking about how the public sees science. Because I know for me and Elsie and I, when we first got this project and we were put together and we kind of talked a little bit about what our different topics were, to us it's like, well, we do completely different things. Like, you work on the development of the chicken nervous system, I work on looking at neurons within the Drosophila memory center, or the fruit fly memory center. So it's been really interesting trying to combine those topics together and really think about, well, for people outside of neuroscience or science in general, to them it is to a degree all the same. So it's been fascinating trying to talk to you and kind of piece together your understanding with our understanding, and see if we can figure out how to put together things that I would see as perhaps a bit disjointed, but to other people might actually be more of a complete story.
I've really enjoyed just
having these discussions between the three of us and having someone new, you know, Ed, who's kind of outside science but really interested, it's not that often that you get the chance to to speak at length about the kinds of things that you do and the kinds of ideas that really excite you. And it's been great to have someone, like a really willing listener, who really wants to engage with the ideas.
That's good. That's nice to hear. No, I found it all fascinating. I really enjoyed listening to both of you, learning about what you do. Like I say, it's been great.
Thanks for listening. Find out more about BioFest at www.sheffield.ac.uk/BioFest.